And now, with Sound Investing, here's Paul Merriman.
I find one of the most challenging aspects of helping investors get the process right is to deal with the question and the realities of your expectations for performance, for returns, for making the money that is necessary to get you where you need to be so that you can retire with more than enough or enough. But there is some goal you have, and at the end of the day, the thing that gets you there is the performance. Now, we all know, there's no secret to this, that we can't see the future. Even people who talk like they can know they can't see the future. We know that the things we can control are things like expenses and taxes and the asset classes that we choose to put our money into, our commitment to investing, whether it's with a 401k or an IRA. We can control the fact that we dollar cost average into the market to take advantage of that great discipline. And finally, we can work to control the panic that sets in from time to time and causes us to do things that, in the end, are likely to do more damage than good. But it's still performance. And while we don't know future performance, I think we have expectations for future performance because that's the big sales pitch of Wall Street. In fact, not just Wall Street, but even your investment advisor is having to make some sort of determination what kind of performance, what kind of returns should you get in the future. So I'm looking for ways to give people a better perspective of performance. And one of the things I've just recently put up at, if you go to articles, at paulmerriman.com, and then you scroll down under articles to a link to decade returns 1930 through 2000. And if you don't have that in front of you now, I suggest you turn off this podcast and come back when you have that in hand, because my hope is if you look at these numbers carefully, that it will give you maybe a new perspective as to what your expectations for performance should be. I have my copy in hand, and what I'd like to do is I'd like to share about 10 lessons. I'm sure you're not shocked that I found 10 lessons to help you through this expectations dilemma. But first, before I share the lessons, let me make sure you understand this table. All I've done here is using the Dimensional Funds database. I've looked at the returns for the decades starting 1930 through 39, 40 through 49, etc., finishing off with 2000 through 2009, the famous lost decade. And then the final column is to show the compound rate of return of each of these asset classes going back to 1930. I would love it if I could show the performance of other than the four asset classes I have here, the S&P 500, the large cap value, the small cap balanced, and the small cap value. Wouldn't it be nice if we had REIT returns going back to 1930? I would also like to have returns from the international markets going back to 1930. But I don't, and so it seems to me that using these four very major asset classes, that it at least gives us a range of different kinds of classes, asset classes, and how they performed in different circumstances. Now, we know the circumstances will never be the same again. We will never have another World War II. We will never have another Nixon as the president who had to leave office. I mean, we can go on and on about how the things that impacted the markets over those years. But at the end of the day, the market is the market. And sometimes it goes down 50% and sometimes it goes up 100%. So I think these are meaningful representations of what was real time, but won't reproduce the same in the future. But let's figure out what the lessons might be. The first lesson to me, as I look at each one of these decades, is that the next decade, you really can't tell from the last how it should be. I mean, we look at the decade of from 30 to 39, the S&P 500 lost 0.1% a year. By the way, these numbers include the reinvestment of dividends. But for that decade, you would have ended about where you started. And of course, if you were having to live off of your investments, you were probably in deep trouble. But that was what happened over that 10-year period. The next 10 years, the return for the S&P was 9.2. Again, pretty good returns, but after a decade of not getting enough, it probably wasn't enough to make people feel like they were getting well. But certainly, the decade of the 50s, where the S&P was up 19.4, that was huge, huge. And we can follow across the table, and finally, we show the last decade returns. 2000 through 2009, after a huge 90 through 99, actually lost about 1% a year. And I think it's good to remember that at the end of that 1990 through 99 period, the expectations for the next 10 years, here's this expectation thing again, what people were counting on, according to surveys, were returns of 20 to 30%. Now, you don't see 20 to 30% here, but I do know that in the 95 through 99 period, that the S&P compounded at over 28%. But look a little deeper there. That advantage to the S&P 500 wasn't just the 90s. During the 80s, it compounded at 17.5. So there was a 20-year period that people got very comfortable with the idea of making big bucks in the market. And those kind of returns get you to retirement much faster. So I think as I look at these returns over these decades, it's pretty obvious to me that I have no way of knowing what's coming next. And I don't think anybody else does. The second lesson, I think, is that it is not uncommon for these advantages, these big returns, to go on for many decades. Now, it's obvious that the large cap value, the small cap balance, the small cap value, those three asset classes, large cap value didn't do as well in the 60s, but these were asset classes that held up well for five, six decades. And that could happen again. And that's the nature of the market. Now, I think it's also the nature of the market that you probably have to go through a very punishing period before you're going to have a great period, but we might remind ourselves that the 2000 through 2009, with two huge bear markets included in there, was certainly could be identified as a punishing period. In fact, to look at the losses of the 2000 through 2009 were for the S&P almost the same as the losses for 1930 through 1939. Now, as I look at these numbers and I go to lesson three, I look at small cap value. Now, I've written about this. I've done podcasts about this. I get a lot of pushback from people, but I do take solace in the fact that of all of the asset classes that tended to hold up through thick and thin, even including the decade of 2000 through 2009, small cap value gets the star. It is the five-star asset class, if you want to look at it like that. And yes, it lost some money in that 1930 through 39, but in the whole scheme of things, the loss of 2.6, not a good thing to happen. But large cap value was down 5.7, and as I already mentioned, the S&P 500 lost money over that 10-year period. So the most consistent asset class over the decades, one decade at a time or many decades at a time, has been small cap value. The fourth lesson, and I think this is one of the fascinating parts about diversification. We say that regardless of what happens, diversification is always working. It's working to protect you from having all your money in one company, all your money in one industry, in one asset class. Because as you can see here, there are periods that an asset class may do poorly while other asset classes are hanging in there. Now, I'm not saying that the period of the 60s where the S&P 500 made 7.8, that was not a terrible 10-year period. But when you look at the better returns of small cap, then you can see a really big advantage. And then when we look at the 70s, if you look at it carefully, you'll notice that the S&P compounded at 5.9, small cap blend. S&P is what we would call large cap blend, and small cap blend compounded at 9.2, but that was a decade of value. And you can see the small cap value compounded at 14.2 and the large cap value at 12.9. And we certainly we know, and this is lesson five in terms of the importance of diversification. Diversification saved people who went beyond the S&P 500 from a terrible 10-year period. Now, the small cap value didn't do as well as it had in previous many decades. Compounded at 12.8, small cap at 9, large cap value at 4.1. And so it was this great diversification that held people together during the decade, the lost decade of 2000 through 2009. So if you didn't have the expectations that followed the 1990 through 99, thinking, and I remember this so clearly, we were doing a money show in San Francisco, and people coming by the booth were saying, why do you need anything but the S&P 500? I mean, you don't need to have all these other asset classes. And in fact, there were people who came by and said, why do you want the S&P 500 when if you just bought 10 or 20 of the great large cap companies, growth companies, you'd be in great shape? Well, turned out they weren't in great shape, and for many, that commitment to technology was a disaster. But diversification did one more time what we expect of it, and that is to protect us from having all of our eggs in the wrong place at one time. Lesson number six. I think it's interesting to note that, and you're not going to see it in a table here. Maybe I'll do it another day. In that period of 30 through 39, we all get the sense that it was just a terrible decade. But in fact, on an inflation-adjusted basis, these many of these asset classes actually made money. For example, the S&P 500 inflation adjusted compounded at 2% a year. The small cap blend compounded at 5.5%. Small cap value compounded at 2% a year. Now, large cap value actually still lost because it had suffered some 5.7% losses. But the bottom line was that if we factored inflation into this table, what looks like a loss there actually would have been a gain, again, inflation adjusted. Number seven, there is this belief that the market is hard to beat. And the market so many people focus on is the S&P 500. And in fact, when we look at these numbers, I think we have to agree that the S&P 500 is not difficult to beat. In fact, you can beat it significantly if you use it as a big part of your portfolio, but you add these other asset classes that have a very, very long history of doing better than the market. And we all know the reason. We know it well, and that is because these are asset classes that represent more risky investments, either individually and especially individually, but even as a group. Number eight is that I don't want to overlook and pass up an opportunity to one more time raise the flag of value and just have you realize, whether it's large cap value or small cap value, what a huge premium that means in your likely return over the long term. Number nine, and I'm not going to talk about this much here because I'll do a separate podcast on the topic, but I want you to look at the S&P 500 versus the total market and see that the total market and the S&P 500 are about as close as you would expect asset classes to be. And that is because they're basically the same asset class. And what I will address in another podcast is how misleading that is and how harmful that is, I think, to a lot of investors who think the total market represents much more than it really does. Number 10 is really not represented here on this table, but I want to share it with you because the other diversification that most of us have, and I have this particular asset class in about half of my portfolio, and that's fixed income. And you might be interested to know that over this 1930 through 2013 period, that T-bills compounded at 3.5, long-term government bonds at 5.5, long-term corporate bonds 6%, in other words, a 0.5% additional return for the additional risk of the possibility of default in those corporate bonds, as opposed to the assumption that there will not be a default in the government bonds. And then to compare that to inflation, because over that 1930 through 2013 period, the compound inflation rate has been 3.2%. So it's pretty obvious that we don't look to those bonds to try to create expectations for higher returns. We look to those bonds and expect them to cushion the blow and the damage that might be done by a horrific bear market. So I hope that this table is something worth sharing with others that you think have a hard time getting historical returns into perspective. I hope it helps you. And as always, thank you for taking your valuable time to let me share this information with you.
That was Paul Merriman with Sound Investing. Sound Investing, soundinvesting.com, and paulmerriman.com are produced and exclusively owned by Paul Merriman, who is solely responsible for their content. For more information, free articles, mutual fund recommendations, and more, visit paulmerriman.com.